it's somewhat misleading because they are more directly controlled by Beijing than Chinese provinces are. Chinese provinces actually do have quite a lot of leeway to pursue their own policy. Beijing doesn't necessarily always know what's going on, but in the Uyghur region, there are basically two governments. There's the government of the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, and then there's Xinjiang Production and Construction Corps, also known as the Bingtuan, which reports directly towards Beijing.
This is Wine, Women, and Revolution with your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. Hi, and welcome to Wine, Women, and Revolution. I'm your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. You can find us online at www.njrevolutionradio. Follow us on all the social medias and get us wherever you get your podcasts from. Today I'm talking about what's a fairly nasty human rights violation that's happening, and I don't think it's really getting the coverage that it should be, especially kind of in leftist circles, because on the left, we know that the United States is kind of one of the biggest sources of imperialism and colonialism on the planet. So we focus a lot of energy on that, but there are other really nasty imperialist and colonialist forces that are happening. So today I have someone from the Uyghur Human Rights Project, Nicole Morgret. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So can you fill us in a little bit of a backstory of who the Uyghur people are?
The Uyghurs are a Turkic people, a Central Asian people. They speak a Turkic language mutually intelligible with Uzbek. They are traditionally Muslim, and they live mostly in what the Chinese government calls the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, but they often call East Turkestan. They are not the only Turkic Muslim people that live there. There's also a large number of Kazakhs, some Kyrgyz, and another Muslim group called the Hui. Right now, they very briefly had established their own republic during the time of the World War II around then. But very quickly were retaken once the CCP won the Chinese Civil War and basically killed all the leaders of that republic in a plane crash. There is a very long history that goes back all the way to the Qing Dynasty, the Manchu rule of the when East Turkestan and Tibet and Mongolia were brought into a very large Chinese empire.
So now there's sort of this autonomous region that they're called, but they're under the rule of the Chinese government. Basically, the Chinese government are definitely interfering. They're not autonomous. They're definitely under a rule of the government.
Right. In fact, it's somewhat misleading because they are more directly controlled by Beijing than Chinese provinces are. Chinese provinces actually do have quite a lot of leeway to pursue their own policy. Beijing doesn't necessarily always know what's going on, but in the Uyghur region, there are basically two governments. There's the government of the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, and then there's the Xinjiang Production and Construction Corps, also known as the Bingtuan, which reports directly towards Beijing, and is basically founded by demobilized soldiers, and basically a large number of Han people were brought in to settle the region and keep it under Chinese control, especially once the rivalry with the Soviet Union was established. So as a matter of fact, they have less autonomy than a lot of places in China.
So I've heard it kind of compared to being China's other Tibet. You know, I think a lot of people may know more about Tibet. Tibet's been publicized quite a bit, whereas this hasn't. So sort of what are the comparisons, but how is it also different from Tibet?
One comparison is that they both have, you know, a very long history of being quite distinct from Chinese civilization, although there's always been, of course, interactions. There's a history of the two places having connections elsewhere. You know, the Uyghurs traditionally are very connected to other Turkic peoples in Central Asia. Tibetans are Buddhists, and they had a lot of connections to the Mongols, and of course, India, where Buddhism originated, those places. Some differences, I would say, the Uyghur region is, although it's not very highly populated compared to inner China, it does have a larger population and more cities than Tibet. Tibet was the Tibetan Plateau, the Tibetan Autonomous Region, is not the entire historic heartland of the Tibetans. There are many Tibetans in Qinghai and Sichuan, so their homeland was divided up into different provinces more. And as you alluded to, the Tibetans, for quite some time, they were more prominent, their plight on the world stage, although now that's changing because of all the news that's been coming out of East Turkestan. But the Uyghurs and the Tibetans have sought to kind of come together to strengthen a collective voice, because they do have a lot of parallel issues, such as repression of religion and language education, that sort of thing.
How large is this region that we're talking about, the Uyghur Autonomous Region?
It's quite large. Actually, I think the single largest division in the Chinese polity. But it's got only a tiny fraction of the Chinese population, of the populations of citizens of China. I think it's about 2% or so. It's very sparsely populated in that sense. There's a lot of mountains, deserts, etc. But there's also a lot of natural resources there, including, natural gas and oil and that sort of thing, and minerals.
So when I started this, I was talking about the human rights violations, because that's really what I'd like to talk about, is the rights that are being violated of the Uyghur people and what kind of things are being forced upon them, what's being done to them, because some of it's quite devastating. Like, there's even kind of concentration camps, in effect, happening in this region, right? So can you kind of run us through some of what the human rights violations that are happening in the region are?
Well, for a very long time, there were tensions between the Uyghur and Han Chinese communities, because they felt the Han were coming in, you know, exploiting the natural resources, kind of pushing Uyghurs aside and marginalizing them in their own homeland. There were definitely some violent incidents, but basically the Chinese government has been able to rebrand what's been happening from separatism, which it was historically, they called it in the 80s and 90s, into terrorism, kind of taking this like war on terror branding and applying it to all Uyghurs. And unfortunately, it seems like they've come to the conclusion that the solution to this problem is to try to forcibly assimilate them as quickly as possible, which means trying to completely strip away their ability to freely practice their religion, and also kind of undermining any freedom they have to speak their own language, that sort of thing. One thing that we are very concerned about, and that many people are increasingly concerned about, is the connection between these re-education camps and forced labor. The Chinese government is trying to brand these camps as vocational training centers, although they're funded by the Ministry of Justice, which runs the prisons, not the Ministry of Education, which runs normal vocational schools in China. So these basically prison camps, factories are being built, connected to them, attached to them. People are being sent to the camps and then sent directly to factories where they can basically be controlled. There's a lot of reports of forced labor. And then a much broader forced labor program that includes not only people who've been sent to the camps, but people being directly kind of funneled into a labor channel, both in factories in inner China and also inside the Uyghur region itself. You know, of reports of, you know, people not getting paid, being paid less than they should be, and abusive labor practices, that sort of thing. So it's something we are increasingly trying to get awareness of, response from, you know, global corporations who are concerned about any sort of reputation they might have to uphold labor standards.
All right, so that leads me to two questions. The first of which, since you just mentioned corporations, do we know what corporations or products are being produced in these regions, in these forced labor camps, that people could either pressure those corporations directly or avoid those corporations' products if possible?
I'm really glad you asked that. In fact, there's a major report that just came out this week from researchers at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Basically, they looked at Chinese government reports on this labor program and lay out all of the factories that they could find that these Uyghurs are being transferred to. And then there are several very good news reports that came out kind of supplementing this, you know, kind of getting as much information as they could about whether these people are there of their own free will or not. There's one in the Washington Post that looked at a factory that was making Nike shoes, and then one by Associated Press that was looking at a factory producing electronics, including Apple products.
Okay, so these are big name products. These are products that are in people's homes currently.
And, you know, what appears to be the case is that, you know, Uyghurs are being kind of segregated in these factories, not being allowed to leave. There are brokers who are getting the Uyghur laborers and being paid to transfer them. And right now, Chinese factories are having difficulty, especially during the coronavirus, where it's been difficult to get regular workers to return back to work. So basically, these Uyghurs who, you know, don't really have ability to say no are kind of being funneled into factories. That's something we're very worried about.
Well, that's another question, but let me go back to the other one that I had first. Do we know about how many people are being forced either into these camps or into relocation? Like, do we have an estimate of the number of individuals?
We were estimating between 1 and 2 million based on the size of the facilities, based on percentages of people sent from certain locations. And this includes from leaked government documents. There were some major leaks of government documents that came out recently, including one that we're calling the Karakash document, which was a list of people who were in the camps and who were extra suspicious because they had relatives overseas, basically laying out, you know, where they were from and their political assessments of their families, that sort of thing. So basically, we were estimating around 10% of the population. This number may be in flux. We don't know if people are being moved in and replaced by new people, or, you know, if they're being sent. There's evidence that some people are being released basically into home detention, that sort of thing. So the number does seem to be in flux, but we think that at least 1 million and is a reasonable estimate, and people are being processed through the system. And also there's an increasing problem of people being given very long prison terms. So basically people are being sent to the camps. Some of them may be released into, you know, home detention. Others are being given very large prison sentences.
All right, which did the next question that you mentioned would obviously be the effect of the coronavirus. Like, when we're recording this, we're kind of right at the, like, beginning to middle of the coronavirus panic. Like, it's kind of done some devastation in China, and it's just now starting to hit the United States when we're recording this. So I imagine that must be having, when you have people in these, you know, camps where they're not getting adequate services to begin with, is the coronavirus really hitting these camps extra hard?
Well, it's been so difficult to get information out that we just don't know, but that is something that the Uyghur community is extremely frightened of, because if it did get into these camps, it probably would be quite devastating given their crowded situation, poor sanitation that's been reported. There were some reports in inner China of the virus getting into prisons, so we know that such a situation could happen. Uyghurs are very worried about what is happening with the entire situation, including quarantines in the region. One of the issues is simply because it's so difficult to get reliable information. Uyghurs cannot talk to their relatives back home without putting them at risk, and it's very difficult for journalists from outside to get to go and you know, talk to people.
Right. And I had attended an event. It was put on by Amnesty International, was where I first heard about this incident. And it was following the stories. I think it was maybe 6 or 10 women who had disappeared, like their families had no idea where they were in this region. Is that something that kind of is happening a lot in this region? And those were just 6 like sort of examples that you were able to trace direct people, but who knows how many unnamed people this is happening to?
Right. So a lot of the cases that we know about involve people who, you know, have relatives overseas who can speak freely. And that is actually one of the reasons why people are sent to the camps. If they do have overseas connections, if they traveled overseas in return, or a family who are living overseas. If people are interested, I recommend looking at the Xinjiang Victims Database, which is run by some organizations in Kazakhstan and individuals in Kazakhstan, for a large body of information about people. Basically, communication is cut off, so a lot of people simply don't know what's happened to their relatives.
Right, yeah, and that seems really scary that we just don't have enough information. We don't really know about the conditions in the camps. We know it's probably not optimal, but we don't really know what kind of living situation these people in these re-education camps have, right?
Right. I mean, we do have some victim reports, but only a small number have been able to get out, mostly people who have some connection overseas, for example, Kazakhs, naturalized Kazakh citizens, so ethnic Kazakhs who became naturalized citizens of Kazakhstan and were able to, basically the Kazakhstan government was able to kind of quietly get some out, or people who married a foreign citizen and were quietly able to leave. Although I think the situation now is even tighter than it was, because the Chinese government doesn't really want anyone to be able to leave. So we do have a handful of reports, but not a huge body.
Right. And even people outside of these camps, just the normal population, are having their culture stripped from them. That's sort of the goal of this, is to strip away any residual remnants of their indigenous culture that they might have, because that's kind of what colonism and imperialism does. You know, we've seen it in this country with the indigenous people here. So it's kind of the same sort of pattern we're seeing as what's happening to the general population, right?
Yes, that is certainly the case. This is not confined to, you know, the people in the re-education camp system. It is affecting the entire population. It's basically the whole region has been turned into a police state. You can see in action some of the most frightening possibilities about high-tech policing and that sort of thing. Although a lot of it is simply manpower. There's just been enormous expansion of the police presence there. So, and the
right, population. I saw a statistic about that on your website, right, about the expansion of the police. Do you have the numbers offhand, or at least a general sense of what the numbers were?
I mean, the security budget, I think, doubled in 2016 or 17. It did simply skyrocket. I don't have the numbers offhand. But you also could see the difference in kind of the elite paramilitary police versus like very low level, like community police. that blanket every village and man checkpoints and so forth. Basically, Uyghurs cannot move freely about the region. There's actually a lot of parallels to apartheid because, you know, people from the region describe, you know, Uyghurs having to line up in security checkpoints and Chinese being waved through, that sort of thing.
And if I'm remembering from the event I went to, it was a couple of years, so you'll have to correct me if I was wrong, but there was even like forcing them to dance or something like that. Wasn't that part of it? How the normal people were being manipulated?
Well, yes. I mean, the Chinese government kind of, there's always been a kind of exoticization of people like the Tibetans and the Uyghurs, and being dancing and being musical as like the stereotype about them. So basically, when they do argue that they're preserving Uyghur culture, they basically point to state-controlled like dance troupes, which can be somewhat demeaning. It's kind of like turning their culture into a tourist attraction in a certain way. And then within the camps, you see like specifically like showing the dancing. Actually, the Chinese government kind of sees dancing as a sign of political loyalty, because they think that if you dance, you can't be a Muslim or a Muslim extremist. So Uyghurs dancing shows that they're loyal to the Chinese government.
That's such a strange manipulation that they're doing to people there. That, I mean, you know, it's all about stripping people's autonomy, I guess, you know, that they have to do whatever the government's demanding of them, basically. So right. I wanted to get a little bit in the time that we have left about your organization specifically, the Uyghur Human Rights Project. When were you founded, and what's kind of your mission statement of your organization?
Well, we were actually founded in 2004 under the umbrella of the Uyghur American Association. So we were founded as a part of the Uyghur American Association to focus on kind of bringing a Uyghur-led voice to raise awareness of the Uyghur plight. Because back then, I mean, you'd rarely run into someone who had ever heard of the Uyghurs. So it was, and it was very rare that there was any media reports on what was happening. And this was before things really became, the situation there really deteriorated in terms of human rights, although people were still facing problems with, you know, police brutality, with, you know, kind of language oppression, that sort of thing. But after the late 2000s, and certainly in the last couple of years, the situation has really become more widely known. So we're able to focus that more into advocacy, to trying to kind of affect both public opinions, public awareness about this, for example, in the forced labor issue, and hopefully policy, you know, in the US, in Europe, at the UN, places like that. And we became independent from the Uyghur American Association in 2016. So they focus mainly more on community affairs these days of the Uyghur American community. And we are a research and advocacy organization.
So what's your website if people want to see some of the research you've been doing? Because it's a comprehensive, there's a lot of information on your website.
Right, going all the way back to 2004. So it's uhrp.org.
All right. And how else can people, if people want to get involved or they want to help out with things, what roles do you have that people, if they hear this story and they're like, okay, I want to do something about this, you know, do they need help lobbying? Do you need help calling politicians?
Right. This is certainly a question we get a lot. So we have a What You Can Do page. If you go to our main page, you'll see a little button that says What You Can Do. So you can go check that out. There's some pending legislation on Capitol Hill. There's, of course, writing to international organizations like the Red Cross or to these companies that have been implicated in the forced labor issue. And simply, we think it's great if people simply tell their friends and become more aware of what's going on, because even though there has been a lot more attention being paid to the issue because things have gotten so bad, there's still, I feel, a lot more that could be done in terms of awareness.
All right, well, we're just about coming up on time for today. Did you have any closing words or like message you'd like to leave with people before we call it a day for today?
Nothing in particular, but you know, we welcome inquiries if anyone is interested in learning more, and we do put on a lot of events and so forth, so you can follow us on Twitter as well.
All right, thank you so much for being here today, Nicole. It was really, you gave a lot of really great information that I think my listeners are really going to appreciate.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
To my listeners, thank you so much for joining us here today. We are here to be the voice of the stories that you aren't hearing that much. I actually only heard this story because I went to an Amnesty International event that a friend of mine invited me to. It was not really a story I had been closely following at all, and that was a couple years ago. And I don't think I've seen any mainstream media news coverage of this more than maybe a 30-second blurb here and there. And that's kind of what we strive to do here on New Jersey Revolution Radio, is expose the stories that aren't getting the mainstream real depth of coverage they should be. And we are here to be a voice of the activist community. We take no corporate money here on New Jersey Revolution Radio, so that's why we need to keep asking for help. If you can, go to our website, www.njrevolutionradio.com, and click on that donate button. Even if it's only a couple of dollars a month, it really does help us. We get enough people doing that, and it pays for our hosting fees. So we appreciate whatever you can give us. The future is yours to create. Go out there and create it.